Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, sitting in for Ann Strangehamps. Just imagine about 400,000 years ago, what it must have been like for the first human who learned how to harness fire. What was going on in her head? Could she have known about the chain of events she'd set off that would lead us to the present day? Our ancestors' mastery of fire gave us the ability to cook our food, and it also gave us another important innovation. We could now share stories around the campfire. Fires have always intrigued, captivated, and mesmerized us. So it's no surprise that telling stories around the warm, hypnotic glow of the fire would inspire stories about fire.
Fire is inherently beautiful in its own right. It's a complicated symbol. We speak about Prometheus and gifts of fire, and in every culture you have these crow traveling up to the realm of the gods to bring fire back to mankind. Fire's sort of the hallmark of civilization.
And yet there's also a powerful destructive side to fire, one that we can see in the wildfires that have been wreaking havoc across the country for the past few weeks. But that doesn't mean fire is always a bad thing.
Fire either consumes and destroys or makes things stronger, and it's also a very strong element of regeneration, both in a mythical manner and in an actual manner. A lot of times forests that are burned, they grow back healthier than before.
Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, we're talking flammable fiction, asking the question, how does fire inspire a writer's imagination? We're going to get started with Joe Hill. He's the son of a writer I'm sure you've heard of, Stephen King. And Joe Hill is following in his father's footsteps by writing the same kind of bone-chilling horror that his dad's famous for. Hill's latest novel is called The Fireman. I'd like to say that it's burning up the bestseller charts, but that's way too easy to go after such low-hanging fruit. So let me put it this way. The Fireman is a bestseller, and it's a hot summer read. Here's Joe Hill with an excerpt.
This is a section from the prologue of The Fireman, and in it we have Harper Grayson, a school nurse, looking out the window at a man who's wandered into the playground. From where she stood, she had a direct view of the blacktop, a few hundred feet of tarmac, marked up with the occasional hopscotch grid. Beyond that was an acre of mulch with an elaborate playset planted in it. Swings, slides, a climbing wall, and a row of steel pipes the kids could bang on to make musical gongs. Privately, Harper referred to these last as the xylophone of the damned. It was first period, no kids were out now. The only time of the day there wasn't a flock of screaming, rioting, laughing, colliding children rushing about in sight of the health office. There was just the man, a guy in a baggy green army jacket and loose brown work pants, face in the shadow of a grimy baseball cap. He crossed the asphalt at a slant, coming around the back of the building. His head was down and he staggered, couldn't seem to hold to a straight line. Harper's initial thought was that he was drunk. Then she saw the smoke coming out of his sleeves. A fine white smoke poured out of the jacket, around his hands, and up from under his collar into his long brown hair. He lurched off the edge of the pavement and onto the mulch. He took three more steps and put his right hand on the wooden rung of a ladder leading up into the jungle gym. Even from this distance, Harper could see something on the back of his hand, a dark stripe, like a tattoo, but flecked with gold. The specks flashed like motes of dust in a blinding ray of sunlight. The man who walked like a drunk began to sag. Then he arched his spine convulsively, throwing his head back, and flames licked up the front of his shirt. She had one brief glance at his gaunt, agonized face, and then his head was a torch. He beat his left hand at his chest, but his right hand still held the wooden ladder. His right hand was burning, jarring the pine. His head tipped farther and farther back, and he opened his mouth to scream, and black smoke gushed out instead.
That was great. Thank you, Joe.
No, thank you.
Joe, your new novel, The Fireman, is a plague novel, and the plague in this case takes the form of a pathogen which doctors call Dracoincentia trichophyton, but everyone else calls it dragon scale. So what exactly is dragon scale?
Yeah, even the Surgeon General calls it dragon scale, or at least he does until he dies from it. Dragon scale is a fungal infection, something like athlete's foot, but it's not gross looking like athlete's foot. It stripes your body in delicate black marks with gold flecks on them. And it is really quite beautiful. But when you feel anxiety, when you feel stress, the dragon scale begins to smoke. And if you can't control your fear, you burst into flames and die of spontaneous combustion. So in the early pages of the book, this stuff is everywhere. It's in North America, it's in Asia, it's in Europe. And treating it is quite difficult because hospitals keep burning down. And, you know, it's hard to treat something when you're a doctor if the patient explodes into flames and then takes you with him. And so that's sort of the entry point for the story. That's the setup. That's the crisis.
Yeah, and basically it is quite a crisis. Like, all hell's breaking loose. People are jumping off of the Space Needle in Seattle, and it's a major catastrophe, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, someone says, how are we supposed to live our lives like every day is 9/11? That's a little bit the level of the calamity. Every city has a major fire going, and there are, and you know, every time you turn on the news, there are more people leaping out of buildings to escape the flames, and the sick are everywhere, and our whole emergency system, from our hospitals to our fire departments, are incredibly overwhelmed by what's happening.
Yeah. I'm curious about how you came up with this idea to create this virus that can cause you to die of spontaneous combustion. Is spontaneous combustion something you're especially interested in?
I never really am sure where a concept for a story comes from. I think they tend to develop by accretion, something like a stalactite in little drips. When I was 12, I read about spontaneous combustion, maybe in Dickens, and was horrified. You know, I naturally accepted it was true, that it could happen, and I was just floored by this idea that your own body's chemistry could turn against you and cause you to ignite. And it just seemed so completely unfair. And, you know, I was convinced, instantly convinced, this was how I was going to die. And I carried around the fear of death by spontaneous combustion probably until I was about 14.
Wow, so that must have been a rough couple of years for you.
Well, I don't know. I think if you talk to most guys who write horror fiction or fantasy fiction, you'll find they carry around two suitcases of anxieties with them wherever they go. You know, I've never really had a lack of things to be terrified of. So there was that. But the other thing is I wrote this book for 4 years, and when I started it, Barack Obama was running for president. It was the time of another presidential election. And at the time, one of his opponents was the governor of Texas, who said he didn't believe in man-made global warming, and Obama quipped, "This guy doesn't believe in global warming, but his whole state is on fire," which is true. At the time, there was this incredible runaway wildfire in Texas that was, you know, they couldn't bring under control because it had been very dry and arid for years. First, I thought it was an interesting reaction. And then I thought, well, what if those fires were everywhere? What if it wasn't just Texas, but it was Seattle and it was Akron and it was Cleveland and it was Minnesota? And then what if it was like whack-a-mole? Every time you got the fire out in one place, it cropped up somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then I tried to imagine what could cause so many runaway fires, and what occurred to me was contagion. And so that was sort of the impetus of the book.
Yeah. The protagonist of The Fireman is a nurse in her mid-20s named Harper Grayson. Can you tell me a bit about her?
Yeah, the title's a little bit of a bait and switch. It's called The Fireman. There is this heroic, almost mythic figure at the center of the story, a man named John Rookwood, who goes around dressed as a fireman, and he's infected. But he has sort of mastered the contamination, and not only is he in no danger of burning to death, but he can control fire. He's almost like a walking human flamethrower.
Yeah.
And so he sort of seems like the superhero character at the center of the story. But actually, he's not. The lead character is Harper Grayson. Harper is an elementary school nurse who is tremendously optimistic and hopeful, basically decent. She probably sings to herself too loudly in the shower. She has this kind of running obsession with the musicals, the Disney musicals of the 50s and 60s. And I think she sort of longs for life to be a little more like that. Harper winds up infected herself. And at the same time, she discovers she's pregnant. And because she is a nurse and she's done some medical reading, she knows that her baby is unlikely to be infected. And so she resolves to stay calm and to try to survive for the next 9 months to bring her baby to term and to try to deliver a healthy child. And so that's what she sets out to do with the whole world burning around her. You know, all the books I've ever written have always been reflections upon and conversations with the stories that influenced me. That's all over The Fireman. There's a strong influence of Harry Potter in the story. There's John Wyndham's influences on the book. Ray Bradbury is there. I stole my title from Ray Bradbury. One of Bradbury's most famous novels is Fahrenheit 451, which is about a fireman who starts fires instead of putting them out, much like John Rookwood in my book.
Yeah, when I was reading your book, I couldn't help but think of the firemen who burned books in Fahrenheit 451 or Celsius 232.788, which is what we call it in my home and native land of Canada, since, of course, we have
the
metric
really?
System.
You're not serious, are you? Did they change the title to Celsius?
I'm not serious.
Because I believe that actually in some European countries, the title is by Celsius.
Oh, really?
I might be wrong about that, but I think that there are a couple European countries where the title was reconfigured as Celsius instead of Fahrenheit, which is a little weird.
Yeah. For the first several years of your writing career, you chose to hide your identity as Stephen King's son.
I did.
By using an abbreviated form of your middle name as your last name. Why?
Because I was insecure. You know, when I was in college, I began to wrestle with this idea of wanting to be a novelist but also being Stephen King's son. And I had this fear if I wrote as Joseph King that a publisher might decide to publish my work, even if it wasn't very good, because they saw a chance to make a quick buck in the last name. And I had terrific anxiety about that. For myself, for my own confidence, I needed to know that when I sold a story, I sold it for the right reasons. So I abandoned the last name, and I was able to write for about a decade without anyone finding out who my dad was. And I wrote a lot. I wrote several novels I couldn't sell. I wrote a lot of short stories I couldn't sell. I also wrote some short stories that were pretty good that did sell and that won prizes and got in best of collections.
What is it about fire that makes it such an interesting subject to write about?
I don't know. When I was a kid, I remember my dad being so unsatisfied with Stanley Kubrick's adaptation of The Shining. I was only 12 or 13, and he said a thing where he said, Kubrick's got it completely wrong. Jack Torrance in his story freezes to death, but that's not how that man goes out. He goes out in a blaze of flame. And I've always thought there was something in that about that build to an explosion that is sort of quintessentially my dad. I guess I would say that I'm a person who has faith in fire, that when you bring on the blaze, people will respond by wanting to see who will get out, who will escape ahead of that rush of flame. Whereas when things freeze and become deadlocked, that's so cold and empty and sort of a little dull.
Joe Hill is the author of The Fireman.
I would not recommend this to listeners, but we would coat our arms with hairspray and then set them on fire, and it would burn the hairspray, but it wouldn't burn our skin, and then we'd just dunk them in the sink. So that provided endless, fascinating hours of entertainment for us as 11-year-olds.
That's Mary Pauline Lowry. She's been obsessed with fire ever since she was a child, and she's pursued this obsession throughout her life by working as a member of a hotshot crew fighting wildland fires and writing a novel called Wildfire based on her experience. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with Lowry.
Mary, what was it about fire that you found so fascinating?
I thought about that a lot, and I am not quite sure. I think as humans, we're often drawn to one particular element or another. I think there's an intensity about it. There's something that's very visceral and of the moment about it. I don't know if I thought about it this way as a child, but fire either consumes and destroys or makes things stronger. And it's also a very strong element of regeneration, both in a mythical manner and in an actual manner. A lot of times forests that are burned, they grow back healthier than before. It's a natural part of forests for them to burn. And that's like a clearing element for fires. So right. I think even though I didn't have language for that at that time, that was something that I was very drawn to.
After you left college, you joined a hotshots firefighting crew. Can you explain what that is? What does a hotshots crew do?
So a hotshot crew is a group of 20 firefighters. They're wildland firefighters that live together, train together, work together, and travel the U.S. fighting wildfire together for 6 to 8 months a year. It's considered to be an elite fire crew. And they were originally named because hotshots were put into the hottest, kind of most dangerous parts of the fire. But then it's also a very appropriate name for hotshot crews because people that are on hotshot crews tend to think that they are hotshots. So there's a lot of machismo, a lot of attitude with that. And hotshot crews are typically, I think, about 90% male. Many crews have no women on them at all. Some crews have one or two women. But to this day, it's not a job that very many women do.
So why did you want to do it?
Well, I wanted to do it because I was always very drawn to fire. My best friend in college, Della, at that point was working on a fire crew that was what's called a type 2 crew that doesn't live together, that just is pulled together for a particular fire. But her sister, Addie, who was a little older than we were, was on a hotshot crew and was traveling all over the country with 19 men battling wildfires. And that just looked to me like the greatest job that I could have just coming out of school.
Now, were you the only woman on the crew?
No, the first year I fought fire, there were two other women on my crew. We actually started out with four and one was sent home for not being able to hang. The second year I was on the crew, there was one other woman.
And what was that like for you?
So when I arrived, I did not get a warm introduction. But then I'll say I don't think anyone gets a warm introduction when they arrive on a hotshot crew, because the work is so dangerous and it's so crucial that you can trust the members of your crew. Everyone goes through a period of being tested and hazed a little bit. And I just was arriving in a culture that was very different than the culture that I grew up in. I grew up in Austin in a relatively urban environment, a very Texas culture environment. I was working on a crew that was in Colorado with these guys that had grown up in the woods, very tough men. And so arriving was very, very intimidating. But my friends, Addie and Della, who fought fire before me, really had given me a strong education in how to act as a representative female on a fire crew. And there are many elements that have to be balanced. The first one is that you can never, ever complain. It doesn't matter if you're sleeping in a ditch in a rainstorm. It doesn't matter if it's 30 degrees and they can't get you a sleeping bag. It doesn't matter if you haven't eaten in 19 hours and you feel like you're going to faint. You can never, ever complain. So that was the first thing that they taught me. They also taught me that I had to show up fit. And so I trained really hard for that. And then they also told me that it's very important to not arrive on a hotshot crew thinking that you're the bachelorette. You know, you have to show up and really keep your sexuality under wraps. The more that your crewmates can kind of forget that you're a woman, the better you're going to do.
Yeah. Now, as I understand it, what you actually do on a hotshot crew is different than, say, what smoke jumpers do. I mean, you're not parachuting out of planes, you know, dropping down into a burning forest. You're doing something different.
Hotshots hike into fires, and often they hike pretty far into fires. Sometimes they're helicoptered into fires. Smoke jumpers, they jump out of airplanes to get to fires. So they are usually attacking smaller fires in more remote areas that are difficult to access, you know, where you can't hike in 4 or 5 miles off a road, where you really need to be dropped in. Once the smoke jumpers hit the ground, the job is similar in many, many ways. But no, hotshots do not jump out of airplanes.
And so what do you do, actually, as you're going in to meet this raging fire? What's your job?
The hotshot crews hike in to the fire, and then once they arrive at the fire, they create what's called a fire line. So they do not use water to fight fire. Instead, they remove fuel. So fire needs three things to burn. It needs oxygen, fuel, and heat. So a hotshot crew creates a fire line which removes the fuel. So there's sawyers on a hotshot crew and there's diggers. And so sawyers use chainsaws to create like a 15-foot break in the canopy of trees. And then diggers come through and scrape down a 24-inch down to mineral soil. So ideally, the fire will burn right up to the edge of that fire line and stop.
So you're removing the trees. I mean, you're removing the fuel. Are you also burning that line? Literally fighting fire with fire?
Yes. Not on every fire that you go to. Hotshots do not fight fire with fire every day, but it's a tool that hotshots use frequently. So a lot of times hotshots will dig a fire line a ways out in front of the fire, and then they use drip torches, which are, they look like watering cans, but they're full of fuel diesel mix, and they have a flaming wick. So you pour this diesel fuel mix out and it goes over the wick and catches fire. So you're basically pouring this little like river of fire through the woods and it catches the forest on fire right up against the line. And that area burns out. And then when the fire coming towards it arrives at that area that's already burned, it doesn't have anything to burn. And then ideally it's contained.
Boy, that sounds dangerous. And you really have to know what you're doing to be able to control a fire like that.
It's dangerous and it's really fun. I can't think of any other job where you're paid by the U.S. government to set forests on fire. It's very exhilarating.
Did you ever run into real trouble? I mean, do you ever sort of wonder if you were going to get out of there alive?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And while I completely trusted the leadership on my crew, I also knew that fire has a mind of its own. And so there were quite a few times where I was extremely nervous. And part of being a good hotshot is keeping that fear under wraps. But there were times when I would look at a buddy and say, when are you going to drop your pack and run? And they'd say, well, not yet, but, you know, it could happen. It could happen sometime soon. So, yes, there were many times where I was very scared of burning to death. And then there was also the constant danger of being hit by a snag, which is a tree that has been burned. So when you're in a forest that's been burned, there's all these trees that are still standing, but barely, because they've been burned out at the base or the roots. And so when they fall fast. So I was often just nervous being in a forest that was burned out like that.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, you have actually written a novel based on your wildland firefighting experience called Wildfire, which really gives a visceral sense of what it's like to be a hotshot. And I'd love to have you read a passage from it.
Okay, so Julie, who is the protagonist of the novel, is working on a night burn with her crew. And so they have dug a fire line and then they're going to burn off of it. So when you do that, you have a raging forest fire being held back by this strip of unburned ground or this strip of fire line that's 24 inches wide that you've dug through the forest. So if the wind shifts, it can blow embers over that line that starts spot fires on what's called the green side of the line, the unburned side of the fire line. So this is a moment where Julie and the crew have lit a backfire, and then they're waiting and the wind shifts, blowing smoke and embers over into the unburned side of the line.
Okay, sounds great.
Hogg came out of the smoke behind Archie, and then all three of us were chasing more spot fires together. The more we lined, the more sprang up around us. Then I saw that the spot fires were growing together on our green side of the line. Douglas was yelling, "Pike, we've lost our line! We've lost our line!" The spots had grown up and into each other, and there wasn't fire on the black side of our fire line and spots in the green. There was just one big fire, and our fire line hadn't held. "Get to our safety zone," Douglas was yelling, and I ran toward it. But spot fires had popped up between me and the fence, all of them melting together, and I was leaping back and forth to dodge them. Rockstar made it to the fence before the others. He set down his chainsaw and started climbing the fence, vaulting over the top. I picked up his saw and yanked the cord to life as the other pikers came barreling up behind me. They all began leaping and dancing because the flames were under us then. I stepped up to the fence and sliced through it with a chainsaw, creating a hole big enough for us to pass through. Archie grabbed the fence and pulled it wide open. Archie slapped my shoulder and raised his chin to say go, and I scrambled through. A whole army squeezed through behind me, and then we were splashing together out into the foul pond water. We stood there, waist-deep, as the fire burned all around us, an impenetrable sea encircling our little island of water.
That's Mary Pauline Lowry reading from her novel Wildfire. She talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, the story of a teenage girl who has lost everything and will burn anything. As we continue this hour on Flammable Fiction, I'm Doug Gordon, sitting in for Anne Strangehamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're asking the question, how does fire inspire a writer's imagination? Jesse Ball is a writer who has no trouble getting inspired. He's only 38, and his CV already includes 6 novels and 3 poetry collections. He's also taught courses on lying, lucid dreaming, and the Brothers Grimm. His latest novel is called How to Set a Fire and Why. It's part psychological thriller and part coming-of-age story. Raymond Tungekar talked with Ball about his new novel.
Why did you want to write about an anarchist?
Well, it's very difficult to be politically engaged in these horrific and pathetic times. And it's easy to want to simply start again, you know. So I think those are anarchist ideas. Maybe also anarchist ideas are largely misinterpreted as being purely destruction and not also ideas with a heart. So it seemed to explore some of those ideas from the perspective of a child would be a pleasure, and it was.
So right now might be a good time to have you just tell me a bit about your protagonist. Is it Lucia or Lucia?
It can be either. I thought it was Lucia, but I don't believe authors have authority over their texts.
Okay.
Whatever anyone wants it to be is fine.
Well, what can you tell me about Lucia? Who is she?
She's a young woman. She is in high school. She has difficulty in high school. Her father is dead. Her mother is in an insane asylum. And she's trying to get along, supported by her aunt, lovely woman. They live in a garage.
What I kind of found fascinating in the book is we don't really get all that much information about her father and her mother. I mean, we get a sense of where she is in the book. And I should also mention that her father passed away. But we actually never find out how he died. Why was it important for you to kind of leave those details out?
Well, I can only say the things that she feels it's possible to say.
And in the book, Lucia is between schools. Why is that?
She got in trouble for stabbing someone in the neck with a pencil.
Why is that?
Why did she do that?
Mm-hmm.
It was because her father's Zippo lighter is the most important relic that she has, and someone touched it, this jock at her previous school. So she attacked him with a pencil.
Mm-hmm. You know, the story is told from her point of view, and she has a very distinctive voice. Would you mind reading an excerpt for me?
Sure. Things took an upturn between 5th and 6th periods when I overheard 2 kids talking. They didn't know I was there, and the short, dumb-looking one told the bigger one that it had been arranged and the sonar club was going to meet at the usual spot that afternoon. They were trying to be real cloak and dagger about it. I'm sure that doesn't mean anything to you. You're wondering, why is she happy about some sonar club? That doesn't sound even remotely fun. Well, I have a friend, I do, who told me about something he heard about from someone else. And what it is this. Right now there are clubs forming up all over the country. They call themselves sonar clubs or even radio clubs, but what they are is clubs for people who want to set fires, for people who are fed up with wealth and property and want to burn everything down. Sonar, S-O-N-A-R, equals arson, A-R-S-O-N. He said you have to burn something down just to get in. And when he said that, I thought, I haven't heard something so exciting in a long time. If you don't like fire, you're not a living person, in my opinion.
Thank you so much. I love that excerpt. And that last sentence, if you don't like fire, you are not a living person, in my opinion. Such a bold statement. Why is Lucia so obsessed with fire?
I think in the world that we live in, there are many weapons. And there are weapons that are sort of inherently masculine weapons, like tanks or guns or money. But other weapons, like fire, is a weapon. But fire doesn't care if you're a man or a woman. It's not easier to wield if you're a man, unlike money or guns or tanks. So fire is a beautiful woman's weapon, and it can be used against all property to essentially return people to a state where they can just be people again. That's her position.
Yeah, I hadn't considered that. I mean, fire is accessible to everyone. For Lucia, arson is a political act. How big a part does that destructive aspect play in her fascination with fire?
It's a large part. I think she sees it as, you know, a leveling tool. But I mean, fire is inherently beautiful in its own right. It's a complicated symbol. We speak about Prometheus and gifts of fire. And in every culture, you have these crow traveling up to the realm of the gods to bring fire back to mankind. Fire's sort of the hallmark of civilization.
So I'm curious, there are, like, obviously political themes in this book. Was actually writing this book a political act for you?
Oh, I think it must be. I think all things that you do with your heart are political acts, because we can draw a line in the world, but there are people who do things, you know, selfishly, and there are those who do things out of love, and that's the real political line.
I think in another interview, you were quoted as saying that you think all novels should have some kind of purpose, that they should be practical in some sense. And I'm wondering if there was, like, an idea or a message. What's, like, the practical value of this book?
The practicality is not about something large like a theme or a message. The practicality is about having the company of another person's mind, which is embedded in the book, and from that mind drawing on a new way of seeing the world, and then having your world be reinterpreted in the face of that. Thousands of books are published each year. Many of them, in order to create the world that they depict, they draw on just a consensus vision of what the world is. And so when you read a book like that, it doesn't change you, and it doesn't change how you think, because they're just using the thing that you already know. But a good book actually puts forward a new vision of what the world is, and thus it's a little uncomfortable to read it, but you find yourself changed, and you find yourself with tools, new ways of thinking.
This might be a good time to have you read another excerpt. At one point, Lucia writes a pamphlet. It's called How to Set a Fire and Why. Would you mind reading from that?
I want you to go out and buy yourself a lighter or a good box of matches. If they are matches, it's nice for them to be strike-anywhere matches. Those are the best kind. The lighter does not have to be a very nice one. In fact, it should be fairly nondescript, if possible. You will keep it in your pocket as a sort of token. Stick your hand in there now and then as you go around, and remember, all the buildings that exist, all the grand structures of wealth and power, they remain standing because you permit them to remain. With this little lick of flame in your pocket, with this little gift of Prometheus, you can reduce everyone to a sort of grim equality. All those who ride on the high horse may be made to walk. Therefore, when you're at the bank and the bank manager speaks roughly to you, when you're denied entrance to a restaurant or other place of business, when you're made to work longer than you should need to, when you're driven out of your own little dwelling and made to live in the street, reach into your pocket, caress your own little vehicle of flame, and feel the comfort there. We shall set fires, and when we set them, we shall know why.
I guess what I find fascinating is that you were able to write this book in a week, and yet it sounds also like you're very conscious of the language you use and the associations that come with some of your selections. I would think that those two would be at odds. How do you reconcile those two, like the speed at which you write with this kind of like meta-analysis of the words you use?
You just write the least that you can. Each sentence you put down, the very least that you feel you can say honestly within the voice of the character in order to depict the world. And then after that one, you put the least, and after that one, the least, and the least. And you never say more than you have to. And pretty soon the book is over.
Well, would you mind reading one last excerpt for me?
Sure.
From another part of the pamphlet.
Joy of Fires. Oh, the joy of fires. If you have ever lit a candle, then you know the exquisite pleasure that fire brings. It is the visible aspect of man's wit and cunning. It is the smallest and most complete mastery. To set a thing ablaze and thereby, without effort, change what is, and cause light, and cause heat, and cause smoke. I walk into the woods a short way to a clearing, a place I often went to as a child. There I pile some branches, I make a sort of structure out of kindling, a very tiny building, and I burn that building, this little building I have built, and in its burning it lights the logs above. You see, even setting a campfire is a sort of arson. But arson, what is it? Certainly it must be one of the most beautiful words. Arson, arson, how it rolls from the tongue. I should be so lucky as to be an arsonist. What a sentence it would be to say, an arsonist lives safely in a cellar. We deceive ourselves into thinking life is long, but fire reminds us it is a flickering. Life is a flickering, and then it is gone, so we must make the most of it. Fire is red, it is yellow, it is blue, it is black as ash, brown as seared lines on timbers. Fire is the pink of flesh and the gray of smoke that trails. Fire is the all-color that dwells before color, that which comes when one feels a fire will be set. But upon what? But how? When there is a fire, people run from their houses, not to safety, but to where the fire is, to the house that is burning, in order to see it. They are not coming to help. They simply want to see a conflagration.
Jesse Ball reading from his novel, How to Set a Fire and Why. He spoke with Raymond Tungekar. And that's it for our conversation about flammable fiction. But coming up, cultural critic Chuck Klosterman joins us to talk about thinking about the future. I'm Doug Gordon, sitting in for Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Do you ever think about the future? Of course you do. We all do. But cultural critic Chuck Klosterman takes thinking about the future to a whole new level. For example, he's thinking about stuff like which rock and roller people will still know 500 years from now. And will our understanding of gravity change sometime in the future? Klosterman explores all this, and more, in his new book, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking about the present as if it were the past. Klosterman is the best-selling author of 7 books, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and I Wear the Black Hat. He's also written 2 novels, and you might remember him from his 3-year stint as the ethicist for the New York Times magazine. He became interested in the idea of trying to predict what the future will be like while he was watching the reboot of the science TV series Cosmos.
I was very intrigued by any time they would point to sort of a lost, arcane scientist and elaborated sort of on how everyone in the world sort of had this established idea of what reality was, and then somebody offered a new idea, and within one generation it was as if everyone had always believed that. And I thought to myself, well, that must be happening all the time. It's probably not visible to us because we're inside the system, but there must just be this continual process of reinventing how we view the world. And once it gets reinvented, we almost pretend that there was never another version. And coincidentally, when I was watching this, I happened to be reading about the history of the novel Moby Dick and sort of how it was delivered by Herman Melville as this masterwork, but then got very mixed reviews and did not sell a lot of copies and kind of ruined his life. And it wasn't until after World War I that there was a reevaluation of it, not just as like a good book, but as the book. So the first example was objective. It was these ideas about science. And the second idea was subjective, how we view art. But in both cases, it just seems as though we are never really right about what the world is like until we get past the present day. So I just decided to try to look at popular culture as if it was history and try to visualize how this period of time will seem to someone in 100 or 300 or even 1,000 years.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about music and more specifically the idea of success. Who is the most successful American musician of all time?
Well, I assert it's John Philip Sousa. The reason I see him as the most successful American musician is because now, if you discuss the idea of marching music, which is not popular music, but it's still part of the popular world, you hear it on the 4th of July and at football games and, you know, at the circus or whatever. It's a music all people can identify. And if you were trying to describe it to someone, even in 2 or 3 sentences, you would reference John Philip Sousa. He is as identifiable as the music itself. He has almost become the concept. And to me, that's really what success at something is, when you as a person and what you did become intertwined in a way that's just, you know, can't be separate. So that kind of raises interesting questions about other genres of music. I mean, it feels to me as if rock music is receding from the culture. Now, it doesn't mean it's dying. It'll always exist in the same way jazz will always exist, and there'll always be some people sort of practicing any form of music once it kind of becomes into being. But it'll move away from the center of the culture, further and further from the center, until it's like a fringe thing. And then eventually it's an academic pursuit. Say in 300 years, rock music will be something people will learn about in a class. And then the question becomes, when that teacher in 300 years is trying to describe what rock music is, what will they use as the example?
Yeah.
Who will be the John Philip Sousa of rock music? Yeah.
The obvious answer to my mind seems it would be the Beatles.
Well, the Beatles are the obvious answer in a rational world. Like, all logic points to them, okay? But I don't believe the world is rational. I don't think it operates in a rational way. I think that we basically create the world in a chaotic sense as we go along, we being people in general. And then we look back on it and sort of knit it into a reasonable, logical, almost like a novel. It's like, I think people have said this before, that, you know, in your own life, every moment feels like chaos, but when you look back on your life, it seems like it was a perfectly constructed plan. We do this with history.
Yeah.
So I think what may happen is that in the future, rock music might be remembered as, like, for lack of a better term, like a collection of tropes. There are just certain things people understand about music, that it's a rhythm-based, simple music, and that it was black music kind of adopted and mainstreamed by white people, and that it comes from the South, and that it has a sexual element to it, and it has an outlaw element to it, all of these things. And they'll take these qualities and they'll say, like, okay, well, who's the person who fits this mythical suit we've created? And that suit perfectly fits Chuck Berry. And sometimes I wonder if perhaps the Beatles, despite being the most important rock group during the rock era, if maybe a singular individual like Chuck Berry will become the definition later on. Like, it's easier for people to remember one person than a group of people.
Yeah, that's a good point. It makes for a cleaner narrative, the whole Joseph Campbell, the hero's journey thing.
Yes.
And it's appropriate because many do say that Chuck Berry is the father of rock and roll, and clearly he was an influence on the Beatles. You can hear that influence, especially in their early music, and they covered Chuck Berry's songs, so that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. So it would satisfy the kind of academic specialist as well. And in the future, that person becomes more important.
Yeah, but does it make too much sense, Chuck? Getting back to your idea of, you know, the world being irrational, is that too cut and dried?
Probably. Like, another thing that I sort of speculate in this book is just this possibility that, well, maybe the memory of rock will simply be an attachment to something else, an ancillary medium. So perhaps the thing that people really remember about art in the late 20th century is television. Television becomes sort of the one art future generations really care about. And if they care about television, they might care about, and they probably will care about, the idea of the second golden era of television, which we're still in, okay? And which began kind of with The Sopranos in the late 90s.
Yeah.
So if you really care about The Sopranos and you decide The Sopranos are a really important thing, something that's worth academic study, you're really going to care about every detail, particularly in the most memorable episodes. The most memorable episode of The Sopranos is the last one. And the last scene of that is pretty much a depiction of The Sopranos family with very little dialogue, soundtracked by Don't Stop Believing by Journey.
Yeah.
You know, so could Don't Stop Believing become sort of the cliche caricature of what rock was simply because it was part of a television show and we care about the television show?
Yeah, so Journey, potentially in the irrational world in which we live, and if the world continues to be irrational 3 centuries from now, yeah, maybe Journey is the John Philip Sousa of rock.
I know, and that seems so crazy to say it like that because we've been so socialized to believe that John Philip Sousa is also the best answer.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. The John Philip Sousa of rock is probably not going to be Kiss because they didn't die in a boating mishap the week their debut album hit stores in 74. I'm talking, of course, as you know, about that Grantland story that you wrote where you proposed that if Kiss had died in this boating mishap just after their debut album came out in 74, the very same people who hate them would insist their debut album is a forgotten progenitor of punk on par with the Stooges.
They wouldn't have even needed to die. Let's say they would have just made one record or two records and broken up, okay?
Yeah.
And let's say it's the New York Dolls who go on for 40 years and become the most, like, commercialized band. Then all the people who hate Kiss hate the New York Dolls and say, like, the New York Dolls are awful. You know, they're, like, just some sort of commercialized facsimile of Kiss. Yeah.
So if the odds are that we are wrong when we try to make these predictions about the future, why does engaging in these thought experiments matter? What's the point of doing it?
Well, you know, all I got to say to that is that's a dangerous road to go down if you start applying it to everything. If you start saying that everything that we're going to do intellectually or culturally has to have a positive benefit, we're going to be living a much different world. I just think it's interesting. And to me, that's enough.
Yeah.
And I know that you're interested in this, too. I wasn't trying to be adversarial.
No,
I'm just saying that if somebody says to me, it's like, why do we care if people in 500 years don't care about the Beatles, but, you know, they care about, you know, Veruca Salt or something. That becomes the band everyone remembers. What difference does it make to you? Well, it's like it doesn't make a difference. But here's the thing. One, it's fascinating that happened, and maybe it's somewhat humbling that we could have misunderstood something that people in the future will understand better than us. I mean, I like the idea that reality is confusing.
Yeah, yeah, it's messy, and yeah, and that's why Philip K. Dick is one of my favorite authors, because that's the central question he's always exploring, what is reality?
Yeah, Philip K. Dick is also a great example of somebody who matters more now than he did in his life.
Yeah.
You know, the content of his books, at times, I mean, his writing can be up and down, but his ideas are amazing, and that's what lasts. People don't care about the prose he wrote as much as the idea behind it.
Yeah. Also, just getting back to why this is fun to do, why it's good to try and predict the future, is you talk about humility and wonder. There's a sense of wonder, and it makes us realize, and you alluded to it before, about where our place is in the grand scheme of things. It kind of puts us in our place. Would that be fair to say?
Well, I mean, there's just a lot of certitude now. I mean, we've kind of moved culturally in a strange direction with the rise of the internet, that there seems to be a belief that if you want people to think that you're intelligent, the way to do it is by demanding that you are right and that you're totally inflexible about it, and anybody who disagrees with you is just a fool. And that just seems to me the opposite of what an intelligent person does. And an intelligent person admits that they don't know everything. They just have this one idea. And, like, what do you think of that idea?
Yeah, well said. Looking ahead 300 years, how do you think you, Chuck Klosterman, will be remembered? Maybe as the John Philip Sousa of popular culture criticism? Do you think that's a possibility?
Obviously, you write a book like this, you get asked that question. You know, people say, like, well, what about this book? And what about you? You know, I guess I think that I will be remembered for as long as I keep writing books. And then when I stop writing books, I will be forgotten. I will die. And there'll be maybe 48 hours where people will discuss who I was. And that will be it.
I think you're selling yourself short.
I think I'm selling myself realistically.
But in an irrational world, and you know,
things like legacy, that's something you think about when you're young and you haven't done anything, because you think to yourself, I could do great things, I could have a legacy. And now, like, I'm 44, I'm in the middle of my life, I feel good about the work I'm doing, but I don't think it's gonna last. I just don't.
Yeah, I get that. But I disagree, because I think you're being modest about your work, and especially this book, because of what this book is about, it gives you staying power. Like 200, 300 years from now, someone's going to come across it and say, holy cow.
If I get one thing really right in this book, that could happen.
Yeah.
If the things I say about gravity end up being true, somebody will be in the future might be like, this guy wrote about this, you know, all these years ago.
Yeah, you might get a star named after you or something like Klosterman. If there's some new understanding of gravity, it could be the Klosterman principle, law of gravity or something.
Okay, but here's a good question. Who was the most important popular culture writer of the 50s?
Oh, I was going to say Lester Bangs, but he's rock and roll, and plus he's 70s and 80s.
Exactly. I don't have an answer. I do this for a living. I have no answer to that question. If you'd asked me, I'd be like, no idea. Granted, popular culture wasn't really something people discussed in the 50s in the way we do now. It would be harder. But that's not that long ago. In this book, when I interviewed Jonathan Lethem at one point, I'm not going to say exactly what he said because it involves profanity, but he basically said, like, time is coming for all of us, and it's going to get everyone. Unless you're like Shakespeare or Homer, you can't live your life trying to live forever. It'll never work.
Well, yeah, but maybe if Ray Kurzweil does pull it off and lives forever, then after you die, I'm sure he's a Klosterman fan, and he's got to be of this book anyway, and then he'll bring it back, you know, he'll revive it, and it'll be like the Moby Dick of nonfiction, the great American nonfiction.
Well, I'll tell you what then, this radio interview is going to be just as memorable because here you are actually stating what's going to happen. So put this in a time capsule.
Yeah, thanks, Chuck. This was great. It was great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
I loved it.
Chuck Klosterman is the author of But What If We're Wrong? Thinking about the present as if it were the past. Keep an eye and an ear out for an extended version of our conversation with Klosterman, including his mind-bending thoughts about gravity, on our podcast feed. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Our staff includes Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and John Merfeld. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Doug Gordon, sitting in for Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.